Here's a sobering figure. Our species collectively kills 150 million animals every single day. We keep countless more under miserable conditions in captivity, in labs and dairies and on feedlots. How will our descendants look back on this time when such carnage seemed normal and even necessary? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's easy for many of us to feel okay with so much animal suffering because, for the most part, we don't ever have to see it. Animals are raised and butchered far from the places they're sold to us as food or clothing or cosmetics. But our insatiable consumption also takes a toll on our environment, and the effects of climate change will not restrict themselves to remote factory farms and slaughterhouses. Rhoann Van Vurst is here to talk about how we could move away from this. She's a futures anthropologist, president of the Dutch Future Society, and lecturer and researcher in sustainable humanity and futures anthropology at the University of Amsterdam. Her book is called Once Upon a Time We Ate Animals, The Future of Food. She joined us in February. Rhoann, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. And I'm so impressed how you pronounced my name. Really good.
I'm glad I got close. It's a beautiful name, so I don't want to destroy it. So I want to start with some of the reasons we might want to reconsider the use of animals for their flesh and their hides and their feathers and milk and eggs. We'll get to the amount of suffering inflicted on animals raised for human consumption. But why do some people think veganism could be a component of slowing climate change?
Well, there's been a lot of research recently that basically shows that animal protein is such an inefficient kind of thing to eat. So if you look at a cow, for example, then basically the cow eats the grass and then it goes through its body, but the cow is also using a lot of that energy itself to grow and move around. And then the meat that we eat only has a very small percentage still of that protein. So that's one thing. It's just very inefficient. But in the meantime, while we are eating that cow rather than just instantly the plants, the cow is, of course, emission. There's the methane. There's the other gases that we now know are really damaging to the climate. There's the water damage. There's the large land scarcity. There's the water pollution. Sorry, it's late in the evening here, so you can hear on my voice that I have a toddler and it's dark outside. The land scarcity is a real problem. But then I think for me, what is the most impressive and the most sad regarding climate change is just the speed by which we are cutting the trees, especially in the Amazon, right? We cut the trees because we need all of that land for soy. And sometimes people think, oh, but soy is for vegans, right? Vegans eat soy yogurt. But 90% of the soy that we're planting is used for animals. So, you know, it's really a count on. And Oxford University recently published a study that I thought was really clear, actually, where they put the most efficient of the animal protein, which would be a chicken. So a cow is really inefficient, but the chicken is relatively efficient. And then they put the worst of the vegan food they could think of, like avocados, you know, things that you really have to ship in for most of the Western world because it's not growing all the time. And they compared, and they still said, you know, it's so much less damaging for the climate if you go with the vegan food than it would be if you go with the animal protein. And unfortunately, and this was a big, big bad news for myself, because I wasn't vegan before I started writing this book, but unfortunately the same goes for fish. So fish are causing equal damage as most livestock farms. So for example, tuna, but especially salmon, they also have high rates of emissions. So unfortunately, the answer is if you really want to do something good for the climate, you'll have to lower down on animal proteins.
So as you mentioned, you weren't vegan before you started working on this book. You had been a vegetarian for many years. When did you realize how many animals were slaughtered as waste products by the dairy industry?
Yeah, and I mean, I was a vegetarian, but I always say, I just want to be really honest in this book as well, and also in my interviews. First of all, I was a vegetarian, but I was a very sloppy vegetarian. I think I became a vegetarian in my teens because I didn't think it was necessary that animals would be killed for my taste, but also because I was just a teenager and I thought it was something very unique and interesting and exotic, right? And so I was still wearing leather cowboy boots. I was still eating fish every now and then. I wasn't super rigid. And I always thought that, the vegans, they were kind of over the top. I didn't see their point. I was like, well, what's wrong with kind of, taking a little bit of milk if we don't have to kill that animal for it? But then there was a time that I was sitting in a Philadelphia cafe, and I was living in the US back then, and I was reading in a newspaper randomly while sipping my cow's milk cappuccino that indeed almost all of the male cows that are being born are either instantly brought to the slaughterhouse or they're filled up with foods and then 6 months later they go. So they're perfectly healthy. There's absolutely nothing wrong with them. But the reason that they go to the slaughterhouse is because we don't need them for the milk system. We don't need them for the milk industry. We only need mostly female cows, because those we can inseminate every year so that they continue to be pregnant, so that they continue to have milk, and then we tap that away. We only need a couple of bulls, right, for their sperm, so to say. And so I was reading that and then looked at my cappuccino and I realized animals are being killed for what I want to drink. So it's not that I'm not contributing to animals being killed. In fact, this is a massive system. And that for me was the point where I almost felt internally like a no. I was so resisting, but I was kind of drawn into this research. And the reason for that was that I, as a futures anthropologist, I started my research with the future of climate changes many years ago. So in 2008, I traveled to Greenland because that was the place in the world where climate changes were already faster on their way, has something to do with the reflections on the snow and the ice. And I wanted to be amongst the people who were already experiencing it. So I literally, I've been there a couple of times. I stayed there for a long time, like half a year on a tiny island amongst Inuit hunters. And so I could really see the social impacts. And then after that, I did a lot of research on the future of conflicts and natural disasters. And every time I heard about the impact that the food industry was having on all of these topics, because they're all interrelated, right? But it never really sunk in. It never really crossed my mind that I was also still adding. I kind of felt like a saint. I was like, I'm a vegetarian, I'm doing it right. But then I realized, no, I've just been pretty blind. I'm part of this system as well. And it felt insane. Like, why would you send tens of thousands of healthy animals to the slaughterhouse right after they're born, just because we don't need them? That just felt illogical. And then I started to research, and then I had to kind of continue with this book because you can't, unfortunately, unknow what you've learned. You can't unknow what you know.
Does your philosophy now allow for people like the Inuit who live in a place where it's very hard to cultivate vegetables, very expensive to import them? Are there exceptions to be made for people living under these very unique circumstances in small places in the world?
Absolutely. And I think we have to be really realistic. Otherwise, this whole future scenarios would be just utopian or just a nice rom-com film. I don't know. No, I wanted to keep things real. Like, what might be a very radically alternative but still realistic future scenario? And for me, the answer is in places of the world where there are plenty of alternatives, not just available, but also somewhat affordable, there, I think the norm should become and will become plant-based eating. But in places of the world where people really are dependent of animal protein still, of course, that's a different story. But the fun fact is, the Inuit are not the problem. They're not the one with the big emissions. That's really us. That's really us.
This is really interesting. I think a lot of people assume that consumers of animal products simply don't care that much about what happens to animals raised for human consumption. Your sense is there may be something else going on for a lot of us, which is that we turn a blind eye to cruelty because we know it's inconsistent with our values.
Yeah, I think exactly the opposite of what the common assumption is. So this book is not judgmental at all, because I think we have to understand that we were all born and raised in cultures where the eating of meat is not just normal. We are taught by teachers, by physicians, by our parents, that it's necessary in order to stay healthy. I mean, in the Netherlands, and I know this is somewhat similar in the US, when I was growing up, the idea was always that you had to drink milk a couple mm-hmm. of times a day, like two times a day, because that would be good for your bones, for example, right? And we've all been raised with all those kind of cultural ideas. Now, more recently, we've come to know that this is untrue. Another example, that we don't need animal proteins, that we can also get the same micronutrients from plant-based food. Another example is the idea that humans have always hunted and killed animals. And so, you know, we're just built to eat animals. And also recently, that story changed, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But the story is now like, yeah, we've had long periods where we ate animals, but we've also had long periods in time where we were eating plant-based foods. And so these things are slowly shifting. But I think the reason why I didn't want to know that I was still feeding into this insane system, and the reason why many listeners hearing this will probably recognize this, like you're going through your Facebook feed, and then suddenly there's this horrible video clip of some cow in a slaughterhouse, and you can see it fighting for its life, something goes wrong. Or there's a friend saying, oh, on Netflix, there's this wonderful documentary about like the abuse of animals. You'll have to see it. And you're like, no, thank you. I think the reason is not because we don't care. I mean, I was saying I have a toddler, right? All of her books are about animals. What does the cow say? What does the piglet say? And I think that's very normal. Like, children like animals. A lot of adults like animals. We spend, you know, hundreds or thousands of euros if the cat or the dog goes ill and has to go to the doctor, you know, to the veterinary. We have no problem with that. We think we really need to care for them. But for other animals like cows and pigs, we've learned that we need to eat them. And because we've learned that, we cannot allow watching those video clips or knowing what we know, we've heard enough about it, or seeing the documentary, because then our whole life would be upside down. And I think before this book, or before a lot of research more recently came out, we didn't have a clue what we could do then. So our brains are just kind of distracting us all the time. And we don't do that because we're careless. We do it because we're empathic. And if we would allow both of those worldviews at the same time, it would be chaos in our minds.
Roanne, I had assumed that people who raise animals for a living are simply immune to thinking about the suffering that may be caused by farming, as if maybe they just sort of manage not to notice what their animals go through. You met this one-time pig farmer in Sweden who walked away from that work because he knew that by giving all that up, it meant he would never have to end the life of a pig again.
Yeah, I think, you know, my first chapter is called How Farmers Can Save the World. And it's basically a reconstruction of a lot of interviews I've done live, sometimes on Zoom, sometimes per phone, with livestock and pig keepers who stopped with their work and instead became vegan themselves and are now producing, say, either lupine beans or soybeans. And sometimes this was because they thought that the future would be plant-based, and hence, you know, transitioning to something else would be more lucrative. But oftentimes it was actually because, you know, these men, I know that sounds very stereotypical because there's also one lady who's being interviewed, but most of the farmers I spoke to were men. They became livestock keepers because they love animals so much. Oftentimes they were fourth generation, and the Swedish pig holder you're talking about, he actually became a farmer because he wanted to be different than the others. He hated agricultural big industries. He wanted to be the small scale, circular, biological, ecological pig holder. And he was. But then at some point, he was feeling more and more numb. That's how he explained it to me. And the reason was, for most of these men or women, they have to scale up and scale up and scale up, right? Otherwise, they just cannot afford their existence. And that, again, is because we refuse to pay an honest price in supermarkets, etc. But for this particular farmer, the Swedish guy, he felt like that his audience, that the people who would come to his farm, they were so enthusiastic because indeed, you could see the pigs walking around and they seemed really happy. And then he knew inside of himself, he knew that things weren't right because in his own wording, he was killing the animals much earlier than what is natural. Oftentimes in nature, for example, cows can turn 20, but in the milk industry, they are slaughtered at 5 years old because then they've been inseminated and being pregnant and pretty much used so that they can no longer serve. They're no longer productive. Similar story goes for the pigs. So he knew that he was sending them away. He knew that pigs nowadays grow weirdly fast. In a couple of months, they're huge. That's because how we've been breeding them. And I think most importantly of all, he knew what their screaming sounded like because he was the one bringing them to the slaughterhouse. And this, I think, is a big misunderstanding. We often think, oh, but I buy the biological stuff, and that means, the animal has had a good life. And sure, there's a difference. Perhaps they can walk outside, perhaps it's a smaller farm, perhaps there's not as much hormones or penicillin in their food as in big industrial farming. However, they go to the same slaughterhouse. And what happens there is simply not a pretty sight. A perfectly healthy animal will have the same response if he arrives there as we would, namely stress. You can smell the blood, you can hear the other animals screaming. And so for him, this was always the moment that he felt like he was letting his animals down. He said, they trusted me. I was their boss. I was their leader for 5 years or however long he had them, or 2 years sometimes. And then they looked at me, and I was kicking them, to be frank. I was kicking them because they wouldn't listen. They tried to escape, and I had to kick them there. And then, he had all that struggle going on. They were shot, they were killed, and then he comes back to his farm. And there's his consumers and his customers, and they say, oh, I love the way you treat your animals. I'm happy to pay a bit more, because with this meat, there's no problem. And he just felt like a fraud. And finally, he decided to go, to go vegan.
Lots of people pay more, especially this buzzword, free range is a really big deal when it comes to buying eggs or chicken meat. Plenty of folks feel like they are, there's maybe slaughter involved with the meat, but that the chickens had a good life. Explain what free range actually means.
Well, it's a diff it's a bit diff different in every country, but I was seriously shocked to learn that, oftentimes it still means, for example, free range means that the farmer has to give them an outdoors. Not always, by the way, in some countries not, but oftentimes it means that there has to be an outdoors. But it's totally fine if the outdoors is 1 square meter for 20, 30, 40 chickens. It doesn't say how big it needs to be. And similarly, I think in the Netherlands, you often have like 10 square meters for 50 chickens, and that can still be called free range because they're free means that they at least they can walk. It's not that they have a cage per individual, for example. And this is such a kind of it's misinformation and it gets communicated to us. If you look at the package of eggs, right? And I used to buy this oftentimes, but I saw on the package, I saw happy chickens walking in grass, outside. And sure, sometimes this happens, but that's only with the farmer around in the block, for say, right? If you live on a countryside, you can see for yourself. But for most of the things that you see in the supermarket, it really means a very different thing than we imagine. It means that sure, there's a little bit of straw rather than cement on the floor, for example, and they can walk around a little bit. But they still, for example, are given preventive antibiotics. They still have oftentimes the tips of their beaks get burned off, and that's problematic because a chicken's beak is its most important sensory organ. So, I mean, this free-range chicken that gives the idea that the chicken has been allowed to wander around outside at their leisure, scratching and scrabbling in a large outdoor space. But in reality, in general, a free-range chicken shares a 4 square meter space with 9 others. So that's a different with what we call broilers and battery hens. So the free-range chickens, like I said, they can indeed go outside, but then with hundreds of others, oftentimes in a huge closed-off barn with what they call chicken scratch spread around the floor. So, I mean, that sounds a bit less friendly than I think we often know when we pay much more for them, right?
So many of us don't actually make an initial decision to start eating meat. We've been raised in families that have, told us that eating meat is natural, that it is, as you mentioned earlier, essential for health. You call this kind of
Absolutely.
socialization carnism. What are the myths that support carnism?
Well, one of them is that you need certain micronutrients, which is true, but you can only get those through animal protein. So by eating only plants and nuts, etc., you can never be as healthy. And most particularly, this myth circles around protein, right? So especially for people who work out a lot, including me, actually, I rock climb, so I need my proteins because I need to build my muscle. I think one of the biggest myths is that you can never get enough protein by eating plant-based. And another one is that human beings have always eaten meat, and that is why our bodies need it. And so if I may dismantle both of them, because I think that's very clarifying for people to know, is that yes, you need the micronutrients, right? And I am the last to say that you should not read into what you need and what the vegan diet has or has not, or what you should eat from the vegan diet to get those micronutrients. I think, we should also not underestimate, especially if you're raising children vegan, for example, you have to look into it a little bit. But it's not rocket science, really. The fact is that in the West, most of us eat too much protein, not too little. So there's hardly anyone with a protein deficient, and certainly not amongst the vegans, because a lot of the plant-based stuff is filled with proteins, like chickpeas, but also just regular bread oftentimes has, oatmeal has a lot of proteins in it. It's not that hard to get the proteins. And to make things easier, you now have all those alternatives, like alternatives meat, like plant-based meats, where they add the vitamins and the proteins that you would need to it. So then there's no more problem at all. But so that's I think a way of thinking, where people say, "Oh, but I'm so hungry for the meat. That must be because I need those micronutrients." But those micronutrients, you may have an appetite for something because they're in there, indeed. But they are in many things. And being vegan now myself and being tested regularly, my values are great. And I wrote a chapter in this book where I wrote about like what are the challenges for vegans and what are myths regarding our health? Where do you need animal protein, if at all, and where not? Or do you need supplements, for example? And I had it checked by a couple of dietitians who I insisted should not be vegan because then they're going to have an agenda. But they weren't vegan. And yet they agreed with me that, I'd researched it well. They gave me a couple of tips here and there to explain things better. But they all agreed that it's really not hard to stay healthy and really fit and build muscle while eating around animals. And like I said, sometimes that's more efficient. There are a couple of things like B12 that are harder to get from plants, but that has not so much to do with missing animals. It has to do with the fact that our land is so degraded nowadays, the soil is so empty, so to speak, that it has become really hard also for the animals to get the B12 out of that. So you see B12 deficiency also a lot actually amongst meat eaters, which is funny because oftentimes the vegans are really conscious of it. So they'll eat enough from other sources, but the meat eaters have no idea. And so they are the ones being deficient in B12s, not so much the vegans. So that's one myth going around the health of us. And then that stems from the myth that humans have always eaten meat. And dairy and drunk dairy and ate dairy. And to start with dairy, that's a really recent development. So 12,000 years ago, we settled down, we became farmers, so to speak. We had our livestock, we kept it with us, and that changed the whole of society, as many of us know. But it also changed our diet. So we started to drink milk. And what we now know from a lot of research is that our gut had to get used to that. So before, we couldn't really drink as much dairy or eat it. We had to get used to it. And you still see that in many parts of the world. So the idea now is that it's really healthy for mammals, including humans, to drink milk the first 9 months of their lives. You see that with a lot of animals. You see it with whales, for example. But after we're growing up, typically you'd stop drinking milk, as babies do, human babies. Only humans have this weird behavior nowadays that we then transfer to drinking cow's milk, which we made up 12,000 years ago, that habit. The other thing is that our gut also developed something so that we could eat meat, because in the beginning, we've had times where, due to climate changes, there weren't exactly many animals around. And so what we would eat were plant-based foods. And when climate changes occurred again, because this goes in periods, we started indeed to eat more meat, but still combined with a lot of plant-based food. And probably we started to eat more nuts in the beginning, which are really fatty. And then that was a way to get used to more and more meat. But the idea that we've been eating meat as much as we do now, that only came after World War II, when the industrialization made it possible. And even if we go long, long way back, you see that, without weapons, we could do nothing towards big animals. I always tell my audience, if I give a lecture here, what if you would walk outside today and you would bump into a cow, a dead cow, to make it easy for you? I'm going to wish you good luck with eating that cow, right? With the teeth that we have. It's just not going to be possible. It's super thick. It's really sturdy. And so only after we invented weapons, it became easy for us to hunt animals and then to hold them with us. But before that, we were not humans, the hunters. We were humans, the scavengers. We would eat plant-based foods added with small animals, perhaps fish and some birds that we could catch, and then added with, dead animals, the rest stick, the meat stuck to the bone after other bigger, braver animals had already killed them. So you could see in the research on how the gut developed that we actually developed specific ways to deal with all that meat more recently. But we also developed specific coping mechanisms, so to speak, to deal with alcohol, right? But we weren't born to drink alcohol.
Right, but again, it's an interesting point because a lot of people think because we evolved those changes, that must mean that animal products were necessary. You're saying they're still not necessary. We just have the ability to digest these foods.
Exactly. We learned how to digest them, but they weren't necessary, and that's logical if you look back at human history and we see that we haven't always eaten it.
First on the line is Leonard in Arlington, Texas. Hello, Leonard.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering if you're familiar with a book called The World Peace Diet. This was about 15 years ago. Dr. Will Tuttle wrote this and goes through a lot of the same scenarios that you have talked about violence being part of eating animals and that whole process of processing the food.
Thanks for your call. Do you know the book, Roanne, or the ideas within it?
A little bit. I mean, I haven't read it. I've heard a lot of good things about it. And then I also didn't want to use it as a basis because I'm sure all of you know that, you know, the way in which the research is evolving now and in which institutions are changing standpoints is just so fast that I wanted to stick with the most recent research. But I've heard a lot of readers of mine have actually also read that, plus another beautiful book written by Jonathan Safran Foer, Eating Animals.
You did discover that ancient philosophers going back at least as far as Pythagoras disavowed eating animals.
Yeah, that's a very interesting aspect, right? And it's actually quite funny chapter in my book, I think, because, you know, the philosophers, I'm showing that they had some interesting ideas. Like most did it for empathic reasons, and they said you cannot have two hearts. You cannot love animals and then, no, you cannot be violent to animals and then be nonviolent towards other humans. You essentially train yourself in getting accustomed with violence. That's how they saw it. If you train yourself in eating meat, you kind of agree with the system that goes against our most humane values, and therefore you will become a less kind human being, which, you know, is a very interesting kind of argument. But some of them were very crazy at the same time as well. So they would be very rigid and not only make people eat less meat or no meat at all, but also these poor people had to sleep on the floor or wear specific clothes, or they could not eat beans because that would also be bad for your health. You know, you had a lot of gurus going on. But I do think it's interesting that some of the most big philosophers, they were, so to speak, the first influencers of their time, right? And they often had schools with followers, literal followers, and talked to people about what it did to them to become accustomed to eating meat, and then what it did to them to live a life free of violence, as they called that. I think it's a bit radical for now, but it's an interesting part of history.
All right. Next on the phone, we have Srinivasan calling from Denton. Hi, Srinivasan.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thank you very much. It's very amazing that, you know, in the heart of meat country, we have this interesting conversation on radio about vegan diet. Thank you very much. I have been a vegetarian all my life. I'm in my 50s, and my son was born and raised here. And I recall a very interesting conversation with one of his friends in elementary school. There was a party, and we told that we are vegetarians, and this one of his friends asked, what is a vegetarian? And we said, yeah, we only eat vegetables. And then my son's friend said, yeah, I'm a vegetarian too, and then promptly goes and has a hamburger. So when we asked, hey, what is this? You're eating hamburger? He said, oh, it's hamburger. It's not meat. So the reason I'm narrating this anecdote is the conversation, the point made by your guest today, that many of the farmers are giving up pig farming and other animal farming. So my question is, with a lot of these agriculture and slaughterhouses turning to increasing automation, the human element is increasingly removed. And you have machine learning and artificial intelligence running these machines and nicely packaged and put on the shelves of the stores. How is that going to affect the human attitude towards consuming animals in the future?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much. That's a very interesting question, and I love the anecdote. And if I can be really quick, I have a similar one where for my work, obviously, I do a lot of field work all over the world. And I recall being in Cyprus at one time, and this was also a period in which, you know, veganism wasn't as normal. And I was trying to explain that I was a vegan, and the waiter in some restaurant says, this is a vegan dish, especially for you. And I said, well, what's the white things? And he goes, it's chicken. vegan chicken. And of course, he thought, you know, chicken apparently for him was not a real animal. It was like a failed bird, I think he saw it. And so I could simply eat it, which was really funny. So I had to kind of eat around it, or I think I probably ate it because I'm a very pragmatic vegan. If it was killed already, let's just have it. But no, I think I love the question because, yes, I do a lot of research on AI and how that is impacting my work. I just got a research grant to research that further, not specifically in the food industry, but in other, like the healthcare industry. And it is indeed very typifying, I find, of nowadays humanity, where this slaughterhouse job, it's the only job I know of that has 100% turnover rate because people get traumatized after working there for too long. It's such a violent job. And the incidents in which it goes wrong are growing, and they're actually not incidents. It's like 1%, which is still a lot if you know how many animals are slaughtered. 1% of them get slaughtered while they're still alive and kicking, for example. And that's because the time pressure is increasing and increasing. And I think we've all memorized the recent lockdowns where people in slaughterhouses were still coming to work, right? Because they weren't let off because the pressure is so high. So now humans come with a solution. And the solution is not, let's see what is wrong with this system. Why is it so traumatizing for the people, not for the customers, because you and I only see, you know, a beautiful package where we can't even recognize the animals that was slaughtered, and also on the package, it just seems like a happy chicken in walking around in the grass. But for the people who are actually doing that job, it certainly is traumatizing. It's not okay. It goes against our values. And then the solution is not to investigate that and perhaps change the whole system, but instead to come with a more automated system where robots do the dirty job. Now, of course, robots make a lot of mistakes as well. And we're still not changing that system. And it always reminds me of a news item that I heard a couple of weeks ago, and I haven't double checked, but I think it came from BBC. So I'm assuming, unfortunately, it's right, where some people in laboratories knew it was a problem that pig meat, you know, first of all, if pigs get really stressed, then the meat tastes less good. And so now they're trying to breed pigs that can experience less stress, and also pigs that have one extra nipple, so they can have even more babies to drink from them. And something in my mind just goes off. It's like, friends, I don't think this is the pathway we all want to go, but apparently that is what we do if we're tech optimistic. So I would say if we go towards automation and AI, we do the same as we do with automated and AI wars, where sure, we're saving human lives, but we're still causing the same or even more amount of suffering. So I don't think that's the future scenario that we want for, you know, this generation, and especially not future generations.
How much work does it take for a carnivore or even a vegetarian to relearn to cook as a strict vegan?
So I am super honest in the book, and I also give explanations of how I failed in the beginning. Like the first time I was baking pancakes, vegan pancakes, I failed so miserably that my then husband, and this is not the reason we got divorced, but he probably was considering it while eating my first vegan pancakes. It was horrible. It was horrible. And I just kept saying, oh, it's not that bad. You know, just add a little bit more maple syrup. It will be fine. It's okay. But it wasn't. It was horrible. So yeah, you have to get, you know, you have to kind of grow into it. But then, you know, a lot of the vegan dishes that I love to make, they are wonderful because they were never made to be eaten with meat. So I think this is a very common mistake of a lot of people who want to turn vegan. They go within 24 hours, they decide they want to become vegan, and then they radically transform everything in their life. And then they stand in the supermarket, and instead of having their favorite meat dish filled with a bit of veggies and a bit of grains, they now leave the meat out. That gives a very sad plate, I can tell you, and also not very healthy. You only have then a lot of vegetables and a lot of grains, which is often not enough. So you have to learn to look at food from a different perspective. You'll have to start from the veggies and then think what might be nice as an add-on to that instead of putting the meat central. And that takes perhaps a couple of days, perhaps a couple of weeks. I should say nowadays there's so many vegan websites, vegan influencers that all give away their recipes for free. It's like easy 10-minute, 5-ingredient vegan dishes that are healthy and balanced. They have vegan on a budget, everything. So I would really go for that. And another thing is that I always insist that people take it slow. So for me, it was really helpful. Instead of, you know, going cold turkey, I went with baby steps. I, you know, that afternoon in the cafeteria, I stopped drinking cow's milk and I got used to oat milk. Nowadays, I think a lot of my non-vegan friends also just, you know, they prefer the oat milk. But back then, that was kind of a new thing. So I had to get used to it. And then perhaps you start with eating yogurt that comes from cashews, or you try a couple of vegan cheeses, and you sometimes have to search a little bit until you find the brand that you like. You experiment a little bit with recipes. So, you know, perhaps you go from 7 days a week eating meat, you go to 3 days a week, or you go to 2 days a week, or you go to 5 days a week. Everything counts. And everything will make it feel easier, less threatening. I think if you do it that way, it's more sustainable. And then if I may, just one final tip, because this is something that I hear so often by people who are well-intending and they really want to go vegan. And then they say, I did great for like 5 months. And then I got drunk and midst in the night, I went to McDonald's and had a hamburger. And then I gave up because, you know, then I'm like, why did you give up? You know, it's fine. I've done the wrong thing. I went back to the old habits a couple of times, and that's fine. As long as you go back on track the next day, we shouldn't be too harsh on ourselves because, like we said in the beginning, we're all born and raised as carnists. And now, slowly but gradually, we're looking at the grandchildren, we're looking at the kids. We realize for them, we want a nicer world than will be the case if we continue to eat as much meat as we do. And so we're transferring, we're trying to do our best. And it goes with baby steps, but it's going.
I wonder what you think about how changes to public policy could encourage more vegan eating without the need to ban the sale of meat.
I think, you know, first of all, I think we're very powerful as consumers. For me, consuming, buying, and eating is really a form of voting. So every time I walk into the supermarket, I show to the supermarket manager which companies I want to support, which systems I want to support, and which no longer, right? And as long as I do that pretty much consistently, I will change what they have on offer because they go with what is sold most. So that's one thing. Secondly, I do think that, of course, companies have a huge responsibility here, and also governments have a huge responsibility. So I would be on lowering tax on eco veggies, for example, and adding tax to meat. So at least if people still buy meat, then at least it's a fair price for the farmer, which also means that he has a chance to take a bit better care of his animals. We haven't solved the environmental problem then. Still, we haven't solved the slaughterhouse problem, but at least they will have a better life. But I think the most power lies with us and voting for the future scenario, essentially, in which we want to live.
That was my conversation with Roanne van Voorst, a futures anthropologist, president of the Dutch Future Society, and lecturer and researcher in sustainable humanity and futures anthropology at the University of Amsterdam. She's author of Once Upon a Time We Ate Animals, The Future of Food, and she joined us in February. If you like this show, check out our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Michael Moss about how food manufacturers have created unhealthy foods we crave. You can also check out our show with Amira Mercer, the founder of Other Sons, a wellness guide for Black women. We talked about her switch to the vegan lifestyle, the isolation from her community she initially felt, and her deep dive into the long history of plant-based diets in the Black diaspora. You can like our page on Facebook. We are at KERA Think on Twitter. And you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or listen at our website where you can see upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.